Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck here in the early morning hours of Tuesday, recording after what was a predictable busy day one. There's really nothing like day one of NBA free agency, Howard. I was thinking about this. Like, NFL day one is not like this. Baseball day one is not like this. I don't even know what hockey day one looks like personally, but NBA day one free agency, you know, when, you know, theoretically your teams are only allowed to talk to free agents at 6 o'clock. Funny how things happen rather quickly.
I don't know what the first day of hockey free agency looks like either, Chris. I'd like to think it's just a bunch of guys beating the living crap out of each other and stealing each other's contracts. That sounds about right. Right. Like just guys, you know, swinging sticks, and eventually you sign your name in blood on a contract. That's hockey, right?
Oh, way to go for the lowest common denominator hockey analogy there.
Our buddy Alan Hahn would not approve.
No,
he'd be swinging a hockey stick at me right now just for saying that. You said it, unpredictable, and yet also, or you said, you know, predictably busy, but unpredictable, and I think in some of the results at least. But yeah, predictable that after all the hemming and hawing or hand-wringing about tampering and the league trying to crack down, seemingly, allegedly, on paper, it's the same old thing, man. Like, when you've got deals happening within seconds after 6 o'clock Eastern on the first day of free agency, yes, all this stuff was negotiated ahead of time, especially deals that were involving sign-and-trades like Kyle Lowry and Lonzo Ball. It's still the Wild West in the NBA. But on the positive side, it makes for a very entertaining evening for anybody who follows the league. So
yeah, at some point, just embrace it. It's it makes the NBA relevant in the summer, and it's pretty fun to kind of follow on a minute-by-minute basis. All right, I want to jump in and look at some of the bigger moves on Monday. And let's start with the big one, Chris Paul. The biggest quasi-available name on the market. I think most of us expected Chris Paul to re-sign with Phoenix, but the combination, Howard, of Paul's age and the uncertainty about Robert Sarver's willingness to spend kind of left open the possibility that Paul could play elsewhere. In the end, he gets a four-year, $120 million contract that will have him earning an NBA paycheck until he is 40. So give me your reaction to Chris Paul's new deal with Phoenix.
Okay, so on some level, Chris, it's a no-brainer. Let's put the money aside for a second and his age aside for a second. I know those are both staggering numbers to put aside, age 40 and $120 million. Staggering numbers to say, let's put it aside. But this is a no-brainer. You were an irrelevant team for 10 years, an entire decade of not me making the playoffs, of being at times one of the bigger laughing stocks in the NBA, of a team that was penny-pinching, a team that didn't attract free agents, or attract stars, a team that didn't cultivate stars, a team that just couldn't get out of its own way, and an owner who refused to ever pay to keep together anything that even resembled a decent core. A lot of questionable decisions along the way, a lot of changes in coaching, administration, everything. Chris Paul comes in and joins a really solid young core, and granted, they were on the rise even before he got there, and maybe they were going to make the playoffs regardless. But we got a team that all of us thought, oh, okay, they got Chris Paul, now they're going to be a solid 6th, 7th, 8th seed in a first round out to NBA Finals. And whatever you want to say about the context of this season and all the caveats of this season, all the strange circumstances of this season, still, the Western Conference is brutal, and this team was a legit finals team that came within 2 wins of the championship. And if Chris Paul walks, there's no replacement Chris Paul. There's no reasonable facsimile. I don't even know who the next guy you could get is. Let's just say you could somehow manufacture a deal for Kyle Lowry and Mike Conley, the two other best point guards in the market. It's still a drop-off, Chris. So, and besides that, you weren't going to get those guys. You know, Chris Paul means a lot to this team. He is not the sole reason that they made the finals. He's not the sole reason that they suddenly are respectable. But he was a linchpin and a really critical one. And him walking away, so many things that go awry there. One, you still need a point guard. Two, his leadership and everything that goes with it, all of his experience, his bond with Monty Williams, and that what that means for a team where your leadership on the court and your leadership on the bench are in lockstep and have their own personal bond. The signal it would send to the rest of your roster, to those young guys, to Booker and Ayton and Bridges, on every single level, whatever this cost you, however much you might be cringing about what Chris Paul is going to make at age 40, it had to be done. He had all the leverage in the world. This was the right thing to do for the franchise and for Chris Paul.
Yeah, Chris Paul benefited, as did Mike Conley, as did Lonzo Ball, from this being a robust free agent market. And by that, I mean a number of teams headlined by New York, New Orleans, and Dallas that were going to be willing to spend big money for a playmaker. So Chris Paul could have, he could have at least planted in the mind, I'm sure he did, the idea that somebody else out there was at the very least going to give him a 3-year, $100 million deal. And if that team existed, the only way Phoenix was going to be able to retain him was if they guaranteed the 4th year of that deal and $120 million. So I think Chris Paul and his agents, they played this flawlessly. They handled it as best you could do, and Chris Paul gets that last year in the deal. The Suns also get Cameron Payne back, which is no small thing. I mean, having a credible backup to Chris Paul is significant. I mean, Chris, I would think you'd want to keep his minutes down for the next foreseeable future. Now you have Cameron Payne, who proved himself last year as a capable backup, able to step in and play minutes in that spot. So Phoenix is at the very least able to keep its title contender intact. And now we'll see if Chris Paul has, his body holds up. I mean, I think his game, Howard, I don't know about you, I think his game ages pretty well. So I think over the next year or two, he's going to be fine and playing at a reasonably close to all-star level. What happens in year 3 and 4, who the hell knows, but I don't think they had much of a choice.
No, and listen, you're not worrying about years 3 and 4, right? You have a really, very nice young core that is still evolving. Devin Booker, Ayton, Bridges, Cam Johnson, those guys are all still just getting better, right? You have a window with Chris Paul. Maybe it's only one more year. Maybe it's two. Maybe somehow, magically, it's all the way through all 4 years of it. But at a minimum, and especially in today's NBA, Chris, let's think about this. The window for teams is so short, where most guys are on 4-year deals or less, and occasionally bird guys who are on a 5-year deal. Your window's small anyway. If you've got a chance, you go for it. And if you have to pay the piper at the end of it, you do. It's the same thing with the Warriors, who I'm sure we'll get to, where they've got a ton of money tied up in their core three guys and probably a fat extension coming for Steph Curry any day now. And is it going to cost them in a few years in terms of not just dollars, but also locked up payroll with some older guys? Yeah, that's just the price you pay for being a contender in the present. I will, quick reference point, because I just was curious about this. So I always say this with guards especially, and you said it, I agree with you. Chris Paul's game should age well because he's never been a guy who relies on elite athleticism and explosiveness. Yes, in his younger years, there was that great shiftiness laterally that was a lot of his game, and he's still got some of that. There's a lot of guile in his game, but it's more about the way he plays and his overall skill and mental aspect of the game, his read of the game, and the way he can manipulate teams. It's not so much about sheer athleticism or that eye-popping kind of Russell Westbrook style. Like, Russell Westbrook will not age well. Chris Paul has aged well already and will continue to, I think. You know, if your knees go, if your legs go, your springiness goes, your shot can go. And that could hurt. But I think he should age well. So I was curious about this, because guards, especially in smaller guards, they just fall off a cliff at some point. There's no forewarning. It's just one day they're just not them anymore. I did a quick run on Stathead, which is part of Basketball Reference. I just wanted to see, like, all right, guys who are 38 and up, because he's 37 going into this coming season. So his 38 year, his 39 year, his 40 year, those are the back end 3 years of the deal. PER is an imperfect stat, right? John Hollinger's stat, but 15 is the average. 15 is the league average. That's set permanently as part of that formula. So anything above 15 is decent. 20 and up is where Chris Paul and guys like him have been through their entire careers. Chris Paul's always been 20 and up for the most part. I ran it at 18 and up and 38 years and older, and it's 12 seasons that have happened. It's not even 12 players. It's 1 year by Arvydas Sabonis, a couple by Robert Parrish, a couple by Karl Malone, one by Tim Duncan, one by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, two by Jordan, and three by John Stockton. So John Stockton's years 38, 39, and 40, and he's kind of an interesting comp for Chris Paul, another guy who was kind of floor-bound. John Stockton was still really good. PER of 18 and up for his last 3 years at 38, 39, and 40. But everybody else on that list is either Michael Jordan or an all-time big man for the most part. So, like, there's not a lot of precedent for a guy like Chris Paul to be a really impactful player late in his career, but it's possible. It's there. And maybe John Stockton's the right comp, too, because there is, like, those guys, as different as they are, there's a lot of similarities, even down to the fact that their peers consider them annoying slash maybe dirty at times.
Well, we're entering kind of uncharted territory here, right, with players that are playing deep into their 30s, even their 40s, whether it's Chris Paul or LeBron James, guys that invest a lot of time and money on their bodies that are able to physically do it. And I would just say this for Phoenix, whatever Chris Paul's done the last couple of years to enable him to play 70-plus games with Oklahoma City and last season with the Suns, you got to keep him on that regimen. Whatever he's doing seems to be working right now, at least staying on the floor. That's paramount. And keeping those minutes down will be key. It's why Cameron Payne being back is huge, and just making sure that at the very least he doesn't have these hamstring pulls and shoulder injuries or whatever it is that might ultimately keep him off the floor. But, you know, good for Chris Paul getting himself a big deal. And, look, good for Phoenix for not being forced to take what would be a massive step back if they wound up losing him. A more interesting team to me, the Miami Heat. So Miami goes on a spending spree on Monday. Internally, the Heat re-signed Duncan Robinson to a five-year, $90 million deal. That, by the way, is the biggest contract ever for an undrafted free agent. So shout out to Duncan Robinson for getting $90 million and teach your kids to shoot, parents. Like, that seems to be the takeaway from all this. Jimmy Butler, he gets a max contract extension. They'll keep him in Miami through 2026. We can talk about that. And the big one, Kyle Lowry, 3 years, $90 million. That will eventually come via sign and trade that will ultimately send Goran Dragic and probably Precious Achiuwa out in a deal with Toronto. The Raptors may also reroute one or both of those players in a deal. So a lot of moving parts still with Kyle Lowry. Miami also adds PJ Tucker in free agency as well. You know, when I look at all the flurry of moves, Howard, the first thought is like, all right, well, the Heat got better. They're a title contender now, right? And then you kind of look at it deeper and you start thinking like, all right, well, maybe they're better, but are they measurably better? Like, is Kyle Lowry that significant an improvement over Goran Dragic? Is I mean, there's some pieces going out from Miami as well. They're going to need to add depth to that roster in the coming days and weeks. You look at the Heat right now. How much better did Miami get?
It's a fair question, and especially when you consider, because let's keep talking about age, because it matters. I mean, Kyle Lowry's 35 with a lot of miles on him and has shown some signs of slippage the last couple of years. He doesn't have to do as much playmaking in Miami because Jimmy Butler does a lot of that as well. Bam Adebayo even does some of that. The buzz around the league heading into free agency was that they were going to lose Chris Dunn. They were going to let him walk because they didn't. There was a sense that they would not be able to pay him. And so, or Chris Dunn, excuse me. Nunn.
Kendrick Nunn.
We're recording very early in the morning, people.
Yes.
Kendrick Nunn. Nunn, Dunn. That all rhymes. If they're losing Nunn, you've also lost, you know, some depth there at point, and you're going to need it now with a 35-year-old Kyle Lowry, perhaps. He's been pretty stout, and is, you know, but you know, he's going to miss some games. He missed some last year. He missed some the year before. You got to plan on that. Here's what I look at with the Heat in getting Tucker, in getting Lowry, in locking up Jimmy Butler. This is a team that knows we don't have a big three, and we're not going to get a big three, at least not a big three at the level of the Nets. But nobody's going to get a big three at the level of the Nets. We, the Miami Heat, are not even going to have a big three at the level of the Milwaukee Bucks, if you want to call that a big three. I would probably not traditionally, but it's a big three of sorts with Giannis, Middleton, and Drew Holiday. The Heat don't have that. So what they do, they get Kyle Lowry, who's just a just pain in the ass bulldog of a point guard. They get P.J. Tucker, who they steal from the defending champion Bucks. They're putting together a very Miami Heat-like team, a team that's going to just get into you, get physical, muck up the game a little bit. They've already got Jimmy Butler, who loves to do all that stuff anyway. They know they're not going to be able to score at the level of the Nets or maybe even the Bucks, but they're going to be a pain in the ass in the best possible way. And then just enough scoring, I think, from Butler, Adebayo, Lowry, Duncan Robinson's shooting, maybe Tyler Hero finds his game again and has a bounce back year. They're not going to have the firepower, but they've got the defense. And I think that looks like the thinking here, doesn't it? Like, in some respects, this is just the Miami Heat being the Miami Heat. Tucker and Lowry are both very Heat guys. But I think some of this too is you've got to figure out another way if you don't have a guys, you know, the kind of guys who can score at the level of Durant, Harden, and Kyrie.
They are a very good team. I look at them as still kind of a fragile team. I mean, the Jimmy Butler extension kind of took me aback for a minute, but then you kind of think about it, like Butler could opt out of his contract after next season. If he had a great year, you know, you could see, you don't want to risk losing him, basically. You could see him maybe going somewhere else, and then what are you left with? So Butler used his leverage in that situation as well. Tying up yourself to him through 2026, that's a risk, but you know, you got to take some risks with these teams. Lowry, you know, he's played, you touched on it at the top there. He's played a lot of minutes. Like the championship season, or not the 2 years ago, he averaged 36 minutes per game. Last year, he averaged 35 minutes per game. He's also not a finesse player, Howard. Like, he is a bulldog out there. He defensively gets into you. Offensively, he bangs around out there. He's become a much better shooter as his career has progressed. But he's a guy, as you said, with some miles on the tires. So, I mean, in a vacuum, I'd say the Heat definitely got better. But Lowry, as he ages, is going to worry me a little bit. Butler, as he ages, is going to worry me a little bit. I do think there's a higher ceiling on their young guys. I don't think we've seen the best, frankly, of Bam Adebayo. I know we haven't seen the best of Tyler Hero after his season last year. I think Duncan Robinson still has a ways to go. He didn't shoot the ball as well last year as he did in the bubble. So I think there's room for growth with the young guys. And I guess I have some fear about the physical health of some of the older guys in Miami. That's probably my biggest concern with the Heat.
Yeah, we're gonna have that caveat on them, right? Like, even going into next season, to say nothing of the seasons coming after that, as these guys, you know, get older. And, you know, Jimmy Butler plays a very physical, taxing style. Kyle Lowry always has. Kyle Lowry loves taking all those charges as well. But, you know, it's really about those two when we talk about age. The rest of that group, the rest of their core group is on the younger side.
Yep.
Can they stretch it out over the season? Can they spell those guys just enough, Lowry and Butler in particular, to get them through a season so that they're in peak condition for the playoffs? You know, that's a really big key for them. But look, you know, there's only so many ways to improve. This is a team that had done everything possible to manufacture cap room for this summer, to hold cap room for Giannis in the event that he became available, and they would have been, you know, near the front of the line probably. And then he locks himself up with Milwaukee before last season. They had to go other directions. They took the flyer on Oladipo. That didn't work out. They had the chance to get Lowry at the trade deadline, and I wonder if it would have cost them maybe a little less than what it just did. Or maybe it was going to be the same. You know, maybe it was always going to be costing you Precious Achiuwa, you know, a really nice young piece for them.
I think it would have been more. I think the way the Raptors were operating, remember, their deal with the Lakers fell apart in part over Talen Horton-Tucker with L.A. I think they were after a real haul, whereas this is, you're getting Precious Achiuwa, who's a very good prospect, but then it's really Dragic, the cap filler, and, you know.
And Dragic was another guy who was already up there in years, right? So you're trading age for age.
But this kind of brings up, like, Dragic is a very good player, especially offensively. And
absolutely.
Had good chemistry with Jimmy Butler. They seem to like each other a lot. So,
yeah,
you know, like, a healthy Dragic versus a healthy Kyle Lowry, like, I would admit and say that there's an improvement there with Kyle Lowry. But how much of an improvement is kind of my question.
Yeah, so I also look at it this way, too. The Heat were not as bad as they looked last season, not in the standings and not in losing in the playoffs. That was a team that got really screwed up by COVID and circumstance and whatever else, underachieved a little bit. Look, if we're going to start re-ranking the East right now, the Bucks and the Nets are at the top. Everybody would agree with that. I don't think anybody would disagree that the Bucks and Nets are at the top in one order or the other. Philly is kind of in a weird position because at some point soon, we assume they're trading Ben Simmons, which we don't know what they look like after that. Are they still a top four team? Maybe, maybe not. The Hawks are a top four team. They didn't finish in the top four, but they were fifth, and then they, you know, beat the fourth seeded team, which was the Knicks. And the Hawks had better talent than the Knicks. I think everybody would agree on that. And then the Knicks, we could talk about them at some point, but like, I don't think they've done anything that dramatically pushes them forward. So there's room in the top four for the Heat to be back, or they haven't been top four, but there's room in that top four for the Heat to be part of that group. They're knocking on the door of it, and I think on paper, if everything holds up, right, if age doesn't derail them too soon, if they don't have injury issues with Jimmy Butler and Kyle Lowry, the Heat can be a top four team in the East this coming season. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't disagree with that. I agree. I think they underachieved to a degree last year. And if everybody stays healthy, if you see, you know, return to the norm or a growth in Duncan Robinson, a development in Tyler Hero, Bam Adebayo getting better, I think they can be a top four team in the East.
So that's I think that's just the exercise for them now, right? Again, can't match the firepower of the Nets. You can't get Giannis. You were going to try. All right, so if nothing else, you've got a core that you really that you know just made the finals a year ago, that you feel really confident in, that you've now bolstered a little bit with Lowry and PJ Tucker. The clock is ticking. You have age issues. You have, I think, injury concerns starting on opening night automatically. But if they hold together, if they're healthy, the Heat could be a top four team in the East. And with a puncher's chance to make a deep playoff run.
Yeah. And, you know, you get into the playoffs, Eric Spoelstra, Jimmy Butler, guys like that, you know, they've got a shot at the very least. So we'll see what happens with Miami. You mentioned the Knicks. I do want to talk about them. What do we think of what the Knicks did on Monday here? Because, you know, no issue with them re-signing their guys, Derrick Rose, Nerlens Noel, Alec Burks. These are all manageable contracts. They brought them back on. 3-year type deals, relatively modest deals, at least by today's NBA standards. But then you have Evan Fournier. And Fournier is interesting to me on multiple levels here. But Fournier gets a 4-year, $78 million deal with the Knicks. Now, there's a team option for that fourth year. So really, it's just a three-year, $60-ish million contract. But the Knicks are basically swapping out Fournier for Reggie Bullock, and they're paying twice the price for it. So give me your take on the Knicks. Did we just see a good Knicks move? Did we see a classic Knicks move, which is generally viewed as negative? Like, how do you view the Fournier signing?
I would hesitate to put the Fournier signing in that category of the old, oh, look at the Knicks going and overpaying for average-ish players. It's not quite that, because as you note, if the fourth year is a team option, it's really only a three-year commitment. It's a big number, but like everything's a big number now.
Yeah.
We got to keep in perspective the fact that what's the salary cap? The new cap is going to be, what, $112 million or something? But he is going to be, what, is he going to be their highest paid? I haven't looked at the payroll. He's going to be one of their highest paid players.
Right up there, a little bit more than Julius Randle, I would imagine. Yeah.
So he might be their highest paid player? Like, I mean, if Evan Fournier is your highest paid player, you're probably not a contender. But the Knicks weren't expecting to be anyway. Swapping out, essentially what you've done, as you noted, lost Reggie Bullock to the Mavs, signed Fournier. They're very different players, so hard to compare, but they play basically the same position. Bullock is a specialist. He's 3-and-D. His defense was very good, very underrated for them last season.
He was
a great shooter. Fournier, also a great shooter, but can play with the ball in his hands. Like Fournier, he's not a lead guard, but he can simulate that. You can have him run your second unit. You can have him play off the ball, but then also run pick and roll. He's a capable ball handler and playmaker. So he's got a more dynamic offensive skill set than Reggie Bullock. That's a plus. And this team needed playmaking. The Knicks needed playmaking, and they needed another scorer out there and somebody who could create a little bit. Absolutely. So he's an upgrade in that regard. I would have rather seen, and I say this knowing that this was a difficult task, I would have rather seen them find, you know, an elite playmaker at point guard who they still don't have. And Derrick Rose had a fine season for them. Derrick Rose has never been a playmaker. That's not who he is. Derrick Rose has been a scoring point guard who relies a lot on his burst, who's up there in years and has a lot of miles on him. And I think there's a ceiling on what you're going to get with Derrick Rose as your primary point guard. Is Emmanuel quickly eventually supplanting as the starting point guard? He's looked at as more of a sixth man type around the league, I think. A guy who's going to, you know, be a scoring point guard off the bench. They still don't have a point guard, Chris. And Fournier can simulate that a little bit. Fournier also plays the same position in theory as RJ Barrett, or is RJ Barrett more of a three? I don't know how it all fits together, but even let's take all that, put all that to the side, just in talent alone, because this is how we generally judge teams, especially in the summer when we haven't seen all the pieces fit yet. On paper, what's the talent level look like? And are they more talented than they were yesterday?
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit.
Let's be clear. The Knicks, everybody agrees, overachieved last year, right? That's not an insult. That's a compliment. Tibbs got the absolute most out of this team, which is kind of what Tibbs does. The downside of that, the potential downside of it, was that it would convince the Knicks that they were better than they were. We've already arrived. And the moves that they made by running it back mostly, keeping Alec Burks, keeping Noel, keeping Derrick Rose, and then swapping out essentially Bullock for Fournier, those are the indications of a team that either, one, couldn't get the massive upgrades that they really wanted, which I think is partially true. It wasn't a great free agent class, so with all their cap room, they weren't going to be able to make much of a splash. The big names were staying put. Chris Paul staying put. Mike Conley was staying put. Kawhi Leonard probably staying put and injured anyway. But they didn't move the ball forward. They're basically the same team. And meanwhile, a lot of teams underachieved in the East last year that helped the Knicks. I'm not degrading it. I'm just saying it helped the Knicks get to that fourth spot because Toronto had a weird season that they played in Tampa and fell off a cliff, and Indiana underachieved, and Miami underachieved. Well, Miami's not going to do that again, I don't think. And we both agree that the Miami just improved. And the Hawks on paper are certainly a better team and beat the Knicks in the playoffs, so they are the better team. The Knicks at this stage are slipping probably to, what, sixth? That's not a bad thing necessarily, except that they raised the bar and they raised expectations. My fear when they got Tibbs was he's going to do what he always does. He's going to wring the most out of them, and he's a win-now guy, so they're going to make win-now moves, which is what they did with the Derrick Rose deal. It's what they've done with the Evan Fournier deal. But to some extent, these are moves that help you in the present but don't necessarily help you build out for the long-term and long-term success. And the problem with the Knicks for a long time has been prioritizing the future over the present. They don't know how to do it. They haven't done it. And in this short time that Leon Rose has been there, at times it looks like they are trying to build methodically and collect young talent for the future, and at times not. Is this a summer where, if they hadn't overachieved last year, where they would have taken that cap room and said, you know what, let's absorb some bad contracts and take some cap room, or use our cap room that way and take picks with it and build up our stash even more of draft picks so that we can create either getting a lot more young players and build out that way, or package all those picks for a blockbuster deal down the road? They could have gone other directions other than tying up cap room and Evan Fournier. I'm not criticizing it. I'm not saying it's a bad move. I'm just saying there are other ways. And my concern right now is, are they too convinced that last season's success means they've arrived and that they don't have to keep their eye on building for the future and the moves that would really push them forward? Because Julius Randle, not really a number one. He should be a number two. And we don't even know if he can replicate what he did last season yet. And if he is your number one for the time being, and Evan Fournier is your number two, there's a pretty low ceiling on that. And again, that's fine. This is a team that spent a long time in the desert. Any success, relevance, consistent winning, consistently in the playoffs is a good thing.
Yeah, I liked what the Knicks did because, you know, look, their priority was to get a point guard. But they were kind of the leverage team out there this offseason, where Chris Paul could say, yeah, I might go to the Knicks. Or Mike Conley could say, hey, I might go to the Knicks. I thought Lonzo Ball was going to be in play for them, but Chicago has been aggressively pursuing Lonzo Ball for months now. Like, they tried to trade for him at the deadline, so that didn't surprise me at all to see the Bulls come in hot with that four-year offer for Lonzo Ball. And after that, you know, you're just not going to spend on some of these lesser-known guys, at least not right now. So how they respond is to bring back their guys who are part of a successful group, who are clearly comfortable playing with Tom Thibodeau, to bring in Evan Fournier. And I think we saw during the playoffs last year, Howard, that the Knicks lack shot makers. And Evan Fournier, for all of his other flaws, is a shot maker. And one thing that struck me when this Fournier deal came together relatively quickly was, you know, Tom Thibodeau has a great relationship with Steve Clifford, the former head coach of the Orlando Magic. Clifford coached Fournier for, I think, 2+ seasons in Orlando. I'm sure that Tibbs talked to Cliff about Fournier, and that obviously there was a recommendation that was a positive for Evan Fournier. Like most people, I wonder how Fournier fits in defensively. He is not a good defensive player. But as I say that, like, the Knicks were the number one defense in the NBA last year and didn't have a single player on the all-defensive team. Like, there wasn't, like, I mean, there were some good defensive players. I thought Bullock was a pretty good defensive player. Nerlens Noel is a rim protector. But, you know, Tibbs is able to make team defense work with sometimes subpar or average defensive players. So maybe he can extract just enough defense out of Evan Fournier to make it worth it on the offensive end of the floor. And as we said, a 3-year commitment with that team option is a lot different than having to commit 4 years and close to $80 million guaranteed to one guy. So I'm fine with what the Knicks did. I agree with you. I don't think they leapfrogged into the top four. I think it's very possible because of changes in the East that they might take a step back. But I think these were reasonable deals that they made this offseason. My big one for the Knicks, though, Howard, like, don't give Julius Randle an extension. And that's not a knock on Julius Randle. Like, he was excellent this year. Deserved first team All-NBA, deserved probably a spot in the Olympic team, quite frankly, because of the way he played this year. But, like, I understand going to the last year of his contract is a temptation to extend him, but I'd want to see him do it again. Like, that was a great year for Julius Randle, but it was the first great year of his career. I think you let Julius Randle play out his contract, and if he does it again, then you reward him with the 5-year kind of max-ish deal, you know, that somebody else out there is going to offer him. You'll still be in a position of strength to re-sign Julius Randle because you can offer the extra year on that deal. I just, that to me, the Fournier deal, fine. Rose, Noel, Burks, fine. But if you wind up extending Julius Randle after just one season at an all-NBA level, when you can just play it out and still be in a strong position to re-sign him if he duplicates it next year, that to me would be a move I would shake my head at.
Well, the good news for the Knicks is I don't think Randle is really incentivized to sign an extension now anyway, because, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the way the math works and the way the cap works, he's eligible for a much bigger contract as a free agent in 2022 than as an extension working off of his current deal now, in part because he signed a bargain basement deal with the Knicks a couple years back, because at the time he was just a guy. He was a guy who, you know, stuffed the box score in New Orleans, but had never been a difference maker in LA or New Orleans. And so the Knicks got him at a pretty decent price. And now he's outperformed at least this past year of his contract and should probably outperform it in this final year too. But if he continues to play at an all-NBA level, Chris, Julius Randle is going to be eligible for a really nice fat max-ish or max deal next summer. So
about 5 years, $200 million-ish, something like that. That's
so there's
the going
no, yeah, there's no real reason for him to want to extend right now, because it might be to his own detriment. It will be a suppressed number. So I think for both parties, it makes sense to wait. And I'm with you. When a guy goes 7 years into his career without being even remotely an all-star and suddenly is all NBA, it's phenomenal. It's a breakthrough. It's a revelation. He put it all together. But yeah, I want to see it again before I make a long-term commitment, especially if it's going to be potentially in the max range. I want to see it again. I want to know this is permanently who you are. And there's no reason to think he's not, but occasionally this happens in the NBA. Somebody has a breakthrough season and then they regress. Let's see it play out over a full season before you go and decide that he's somebody who you're committing to for the long term at a really high number. And I think that's probably the way this will play out. But in a lot of ways the Knicks were already playing with house money, right? They were way better than anybody expected this past season. They're ahead of the game. They could afford to be patient. I don't know if signing Fournier is a sign of patience and stability or a sign of getting a little antsy to try to keep moving forward and doing it with a guy who, you know, isn't really a massive difference maker, but he is a good player and he's much better than what he showed in Boston last year. So nobody should judge Fournier on what he did for that last half season in Boston. He was dealing with COVID and the aftermath of that. Fournier is a very good player.
You're right about the Randle extension. Bobby Marks over at ESPN wrote that Randle can only get a 4-year, $106 million extension. That's probably something the Knicks would be willing to swallow, but I agree with you. I think Randle probably wants to go into free agency next summer and see if he can get that, you know, 5-year max from New York. So maybe it works out best for both sides to play this thing out and see what happens. Last thought on Fournier. Why do you think Boston punted on this? Like, the Celtics used that Gordon Hayward trade exception to bring in Evan Fournier. That was their big asset last season. And they had to know coming in that this was going to be the market for Fournier, that he would be somewhere between $15 and $20 million per season. They had to know that because everybody knew that. And yet the Celtics didn't sound like they made any kind of competitive offer. Gary Washburn over at the Globe, who is in Tokyo, spoke to Fournier after his game on Monday, and Fournier basically said, yeah, we just couldn't come to an agreement with the Celtics. You know, what do you make of that, Howard, that the Celtics just kind of waved goodbye to Evan Fournier after, you know, using their biggest asset to go and get him?
And used the rest of that asset from the Gordon Hayward trade exception to get Josh Richardson to replace Fournier, presumably.
Yeah.
And maybe the writing was on the wall the second they made that move a few days ago. It's curious. Richardson at his best is certainly the better defender of the two, and maybe Brad Stevens is thinking we got to start rebuilding the defensive backbone of this team, and maybe he thought that he was the better option in that regard. But I liked when they picked up Fournier at the time, because, you know, I'm big on, like, have as many playmakers on the court at a time as possible, right? If you've got playmakers at every position, your offense is that much more dynamic and unpredictable, that many more guys who can create for themselves or each other. And I like the idea of Fournier as a secondary ball handler out there. So it's a curious decision. I don't know, you know, we've got a brand new front office there with Brad Stevens. First time he's ever been in charge of you know, orchestrating the roster as opposed to deploying it. I'll be curious when all this is said and done in a few days and everything becomes official and Brad Stevens is sitting at a podium again explaining their offseason decisions, why they opted for Richardson over Fournier. I don't have a great guess other than defense over offense to some extent. It is interesting. It is interesting that the Knicks were willing to pay Fournier clearly more than the Celtics were.
Well, you know, it's pretty clear from the moves Brad Stevens has made as top basketball executive that he believes this roster needed an overhaul. You've seen some of the deals he's done, from Kemba Walker being shipped out very quickly into the Brad Stevens regime, Tristan Thompson being moved out, now Evan Fournier. Celtics may not be done. I mean, I don't know what happens with Marcus Smart, who represents now their best trade asset going into next season, expiring contract at a very manageable number for Marcus Smart. So, you know, Brad Stevens seems committed to kind of shredding this roster and clearly views it in a different way than Danny Ainge does. I just look at the Celtics team and, like, they're going to have to find backcourt playmakers, because as it stands, you've got Richardson, you've got Smart, you've got Peyton Pritchard. These guys all have strengths, don't get me wrong, but I don't think you'd describe any of them really as playmakers. And that's
Smart,
something the Celtics...
Yeah. Smart's a good playmaker, but no, he's not guy you want as your lead playmaker.
Right. He's a playmaker, and when he gets hot, he can shoot the ball, and he's an excellent defender. Like, those are key. Like you put Smart and Josh Richardson in the backcourt together, that's a pretty good defensive backcourt, for sure. Which is opposed to, like, what we saw at times with Kemba Walker and Evan Fournier, which was the exact opposite. So I think you can have... And Brad Stevens has talked about this, an edginess to this team. So I think you can have that with Smart and Richardson in the backcourt. I just, you know, where does the offense... Like, Philadelphia thought they had that for a minute. Then they traded Richardson because they needed more offensive firepower. They acquired Seth Curry in a deal with Dallas for that. I think Boston may... If this is the team they go into the season with, they may run into a similar problem.
Yeah, Richardson has not been as good in Dallas and Philly as he was in those years in Miami, and maybe right. Boston feels like they can still find that guy again. Can we call this a repudiation? Brad Stevens' repudiation of the Danny Ainge regime?
Kinda. And I wrote this on SI.com on Monday. Like, you know, I mean, Smart's a valuable guy, and he's certainly a cult figure in Boston. The idea that you could trade him is met with, like, major blowback from Celtics fans. But everything I was told was that, you know, Danny Ainge valued Marcus Smart differently. You know, Danny Ainge looked at Marcus Smart as like an all-star type player. I don't think Brad Stevens has that same mindset going into the rest of the offseason here. Not to say Marcus Smart won't be back with Boston. They're not going to offload him. It's not like we got to be done with Marcus Smart. No, he's a really valuable asset. I just, you know, Marcus Smart has always been in trade rumors in Boston, like dating back to like the Anthony Davis stuff. Like, he was viewed as a piece to that puzzle. He's always going to be in trade rumors, but I think that trade rumors might have a little more teeth in the Brad Stevens regime when it comes to Marcus Smart than they did with Danny Ainge, who I think viewed him a lot differently than how Brad Stevens viewed him.
Yeah, and last thought on this. The Celtics, another one of those teams I should have mentioned earlier as underachievers in the East, right? Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, definitely one of the better 1-2 punches you're going to find, especially in the Eastern Conference. That's another team that should have been better than they were in a, you know...
I don't know what, like... There's clearly more dominoes to fall with the Celtics,
yes,
right? Like,
I agree.
You can't go into next season with, like... I mean, your front court depth is basically, what, Rob Williams and Al Horford at this point. Rob Williams, who's perpetually... Rob Williams is a very good player, by the way. Yeah. If Rob Williams has a healthy season next year, he's going to get paid. But he has been banged up and inconsistent. Al Horford kind of redeemed himself in Oklahoma City, but he's still, I think, 35 years old. So you've got to add some depth to the front court. You've got to add a playmaker in the back court. Maybe it's a Bryn Forbes type, something like that. But, you know, this is not the Celtics team that's going to go into the season. They're going to need to add pieces to this mix, no question. All right, let's run through a couple of things real quick. Chicago, like, the Bulls have been very aggressive in the Arturas Karnisovich era, no question. Like, they go out and trade 2 first-round draft picks to get Nikola Vucevic. That didn't work, not by any fault of Vucevic. They had COVID issues, Zach LaVine, things like that. They missed the playoffs. They wound up giving up a top-10 pick to Orlando as a result of that. Now they go out and spend $80-plus million on Lonzo Ball. They spend $37 million on Lonzo Ball's former teammate, Alex Caruso, in a strange signing with the Lakers. Yeah, like, They're better, Howard, but, like, are they kind of assembling, like, the world's most expensive six seed? Like, it just, I mean, they're good. Like, they're good, they're competitive, and maybe that's what's important right now to the Bulls front office, because it's been a bit of a while since the Bulls have been a really competitive team. And maybe you want to show Zach LaVine something as LaVine kind of enters, you know, contract extension time of his own. But I look at this Bulls roster, and look, I love Lonzo Ball, because I think Lonzo being put in like a functional situation perhaps for the first time, like you look at his time with LA, not functional. The last couple of years in New Orleans, they've been kind of a mess. Yeah. I think you put him in a functional situation, he has a chance to really thrive. And that is a pass-first guy that I think will really help guys like LaVine and Vucevic and others from that backcourt position. But I don't put them in the top four in the East. I don't put them in the top five. I mean, I think they're kind of the leader of the pack of that 6-7-8 group right now. And they've spent a lot of money to go and do it.
I just love this new wrinkle in the NBA where the Lakers have become the point guard farm system for the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
Grooming Lonzo Ball and Alex Caruso for the Bulls, apparently. I'm more baffled by the Pelicans letting Lonzo walk away. Or maybe Lonzo just decided he wanted to walk away. Maybe this is more about him. But I'm more baffled by the Pelicans not doing more to retain Lonzo Ball than I am by the Bulls going all out to get him. I also like Ball. And if you look at the Bulls over the last several years, and this has been a rough, you know, long stretch for the Bulls. They have not been good for a while, and they have had a revolving door at point guard. They haven't really had somebody to rely on there for a long time. And Ball fills the need, but also he brings a defensive tenacity and versatility to that position. This is a team that built around, let's see what happens with Markkanen, but with LaVine and Markkanen and other guys, they had plenty of offense. They just couldn't stop anybody. And Lonzo Ball is going to bring defense. Alex Caruso busts his ass on defense. They've brought in a couple of guys who are going to bring a certain tenacity to that team for Billy Donovan. And I think that alone is an upgrade. Plus, Ball is an elite playmaker. They didn't have that. Kobe White is more of a shooter and scorer than playmaker. And they've got maybe a little bit of a glut at guard right now. So let's see how that shakes out. I'm not even guaranteeing they're a playoff team. I mean, you're talking about them 6-7-8 somewhere in there. I mean, the locks of the playoffs, you know, Philly yet to be seen with Simmons and all that still, but Philly's in. So Philly, Brooklyn, Milwaukee, Knicks, Hawks, Heat, and I think Celtics still. That's seven teams right there. The Wizards probably are taking somewhat of a step back, maybe. The Pacers.
Maybe not, though.
Or maybe, you know, not.
I think yeah, those pieces fit the Wizards better than Russell, right, Westbrook did, especially if the Spencer Dinwiddie deal comes together, as it seems like it's likely. I mean, Kyle Kuzma joins Rui Hachimura, some young guys on that, sure, roster. Kadarius Caldwell-Pope is a 40% three-point shooter. Might be better.
They might be the rare version of a team where one star plus a really good supporting cast is better than two stars. Maybe. The Pacers underachieved. Another team that underachieved in the East last year. The Pacers should be back in the mix. The Hornets are a young team on the rise. The Raptors, I don't know which direction they're going right now.
Probably south.
What's that?
Probably south. Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably. I don't think they keep. If they wind up with Goran Dragic as part of that deal, I wouldn't be surprised to see Dragic rerouted to, say, Dallas.
Yeah.
Or another team out there.
So there's a bunch of teams that are in the running for maybe 7 through 10. But I mean, I'd vote pencil in with the Celtics as the 7th out of the 7. I would pencil in 7 teams already in the playoffs. Now, granted, we get the play-in again, so maybe we should be talking about, you know, getting through to 10. But anyway, the Bulls are in the mix, but we thought the Bulls were in the mix a few times the last few years, and they continually disappoint.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're spending. That's what's noticeable with this team. And
By the way, have we gone like 50 minutes without actually talking about the Lakers other than referencing them being a farm system?
Well, I mean, like the Lakers, like I feel like we – because the Westbrook trade happened mid last week, we kind of missed the window on that. But like the Lakers, I hesitate to get to react too strongly about the Lakers. I don't think they're done yet. They still have the Dennis Schroeder potential sign and trade, though I have no idea what happens there, Howard. Like, no. I want to like reflexively say that Schroeder blew it, because Schroeder was offered the 4-year, $84 million extension from the Lakers last season, turned it down, considered himself like a $20 million per year player. And now I don't know where he goes. Like, the Wizards used their cap space. Could Dallas get in the mix for Dennis Schroeder? I don't know. I thought Chicago was a potential lit. Like, yeah, I mean, New Orleans could. They bring in Devontae Graham and they trade for Thomas Satoransky, so they're kind of filling up their backcourt right now.
Yeah.
And Schroeder, like, as talented as he is, and I think his reputation somewhat is not fair, because I thought he kind of rebuilt that a little bit in Oklahoma City, and, you know, the way he played, I think it was fine for the Lakers, and last season ended poorly in part because, I mean, the guy came back from COVID quickly, or as quickly as he could, and then got back into the lineup, and that's always an adjustment. But I don't know what the marketplace looks like. Maybe it is New Orleans on some kind of deal. Maybe the Knicks could find a way into the mix, though they've used up all their cap space at this point. Like, it's hard for me to see Schroeder finding a home at even at the contract the Lakers were offering him. You know, that 4-year, $84 million deal. Like, people have talked about, you know, maybe the Lakers can get back in the mix for Buddy Hield involving Dennis Schroeder. Kings don't want Dennis Schroeder. Like, they don't want Dennis Schroeder there. So, like, what are you going to do? So I would assume in the next couple of days, you know, maybe as early as Tuesday, that we see Rob Pelinka and the Lakers get creative with some of the machinations of these deals.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Lakers right now, they don't look as good defensively as they were last year. They moved out a lot of pieces and didn't bring back the same level of defensive players. They're older. Like, they brought in some guys, whether it's Kent Bazemore, Dwight Howard. We saw Marc Gasol say he's coming back. Like, they're an old team right now. We still don't know what's going to happen with Talen Horton-Tucker. Like, is there a team out there that's going to make him an offer as a restricted
free agent? The untouchable Talen Horton-Tucker.
Exactly. So, like, right now, I'm concerned about the Lakers, but I feel like the dust needs to settle before you start to panic about the Lakers.
I'm not going to panic about the Lakers, but I mean, listen, I didn't like the Westbrook deal. You and I have not talked about that deal since it happened, I don't think, but I didn't really like the Westbrook deal for them. And whether they got him or not, my question going into this offseason was, okay, Rob Pelinka, you got LeBron who wanted to come to LA. You got Anthony Davis who was going to move heaven and earth to get to LA. You got the guys who wanted to be there regardless. Getting the stars was almost the easy part, not to diminish it. But what do you do now? Because your supporting cast has frayed. You don't have a lot of assets to work with because you sent them all out to get Anthony Davis. You don't have cap room to work with. What can you do to just restore, replenish this roster? I actually think they did pretty well on night one, getting Bazemore, Dwight Howard, Trevor Ariza, Wayne Ellington. And while those guys all have some miles on them, a lot of miles collectively, especially Ariza and Dwight, Ariza's a 3-and-D guy. Dwight gives you interior D. Wayne Ellington provides some decent defense on the perimeter. Bazemore as well. You got some shooting back there. It's a good haul. I think they did fine, except it still goes back to who are those guys supplementing? Well, they're supplementing a big three in which the third guy, Russell Westbrook, to me wasn't a great fit to begin with. We'll see how that works out. But I'm in the camp of would have rather liked to see them get Buddy Hield, even though Buddy Hield is not the same level of player as Russell Westbrook.
Somebody, you know, he's not, but that doesn't matter. What matters is fit. And,
yes.
You know, the criticism of Buddy Hield that I heard in the aftermath of that deal, well, he's never played for a winner. There's some emptiness to his numbers. But one assistant coach texted me after that deal fell through. And by the way, of all the coaches and executives I've talked to, nobody really understands the Westbrook deal compared to the Hield one. Like, we're not alone on an island here. Like, there's
no, the majority opinion, I believe, is what the heck are they doing?
A vast majority opinion. But, you know, somebody brought this to my attention, and they're right. Like, what shooter has not thrived off of LeBron James? Like, Kyle Korver probably extended his career by like 3 years from his time with LeBron James. Like, shooters just tend to thrive in that environment because LeBron is going to find them and he's going to maximize their value. And I feel like Hield at 28 years old, who, despite whatever you think about his scoring numbers, was shooting close to or above 40% from three over the last four seasons. I feel like he would have thrived in that situation. And I think his game would have risen playing for a contender for the first time in his career. So I would have greatly preferred all that. Look, I agree. Like, Dwight Howard probably never should have left L.A. Like, he just makes sense with the Lakers. Wayne Ellington can do a little bit of everything. Trevor Ariza can do a little bit of everything. Kent Bazemore can do a little bit of everything. Some versatility at those positions. I still wonder. Yeah. I still think they took a step back defensively, at least with the current roster they have. And, you know, we spend all this time, Howard, talking about shooting and how much shooting matters in the NBA. They just don't have it right now. And good defenses are going to find ways to shrink the floor. On top of that, you're going to have, I mean, like, I don't know how Frank Vogel is going to coach this team, but you're probably going to have LeBron play more four and Anthony Davis play more five. So you can have those 2-3 slots for shooters and floor spacers. So you can not have teams create this shell in the paint and dare Westbrook and others to beat you from the outside.
I mean, look, Ellington's a really good shooter. Trevor Ariza's a good three-point shooter. Bazemore's a three-point shooter. Like, they did upgrade themselves in terms of shooting. It's just there's some caveats there because Ariza's got a lot of miles on him, and like, you got to be able to still keep him out there for other purposes too. You know, Wayne Ellington's going to be 34 in November. It's a really old team. But like I say, I think they did okay. I still would have rather have seen Buddy Hield there than Russell Westbrook. I question the functionality of this team, right? If LeBron James is, and he is, your best everything, and you want the ball in his hands as much as possible, then what is Westbrook doing when the ball is in LeBron's hands? Same question we asked when Westbrook joined James Harden. You don't want to take the ball out of the hands of your best player. And that lasted all of a year in Houston and wasn't all that great. I know there were moments, but the end result is the end result. The good news for the Lakers is it means that if LeBron has to miss 6 weeks again, which you hope he doesn't, Westbrook can run the team. The good news is that when LeBron goes to the bench, if you're trying to measure out his minutes in his age 37 year, then the offense won't necessarily fall off a cliff the way it did when LeBron was on the bench. Like, you have an elite creator out there in Westbrook. So I like him almost as a backup, but I don't necessarily like opening and closing games with those two out there together because I don't know that it works.
I agree. And to your point about the three-point shooting, Kent Bazemore shot about 40% from three last year. Wayne Ellington shot 42% from three last year. Trevor Ariza with Miami shot about 35% from three last year. So you've got, they can shoot the ball a little bit. My point, though, was if you don't play LeBron at four and AD at five, you're talking about Westbrook, LeBron, Davis, and some combination of Dwight Howard and Marc Gasol. Like, that's not a... And then you can plug in whoever one you want, but I think you've got to have more shooting to be successful. As great as LeBron is, and maybe his talents can still override all the norms. I mean, that certainly is possible. I mean, the guy's unbelievable still at this age. But it feels like to me that it's going to have to be a more consistent lineup where LeBron is four, Davis is five, so you can get two shooters out there on the floor at any given time. That's more of a coaching issue, I think, for Frank Vogel moving forward that he's going to have to figure out.
And an Anthony Davis issue. You know, Anthony Davis.
And LeBron issue. LeBron doesn't love the idea of, like, playing power forward. Like, he did it in Miami, kind of, but you saw Shane Battier doing all the dirty work, you know, when he was out there as the nominal three. Like, Battier was always grappling with whatever power forward was out there trying to post him up. So it's going to be interesting to see how the lineup plays out with that team. Let me finish here, Howard. Just kind of run down, you know, maybe a winner for you or perplexing team for you. Give me, I'll give you mine first, actually. My winner is strangely San Antonio in a weird way. Like, I thought the Spurs had a nice day on Monday. They're not a contender. They still got a bunch of cap space, but I thought they spent judiciously. They were, I think, the worst three-point shooting team in the league last year. They add Doug McDermott on a three-year, $42 million deal. I like that for the Spurs. I'm a big fan of Zach Collins. I think that whatever team landed Zach Collins, and I thought Oklahoma City had the best chance at it, but I think Zach Collins on the right deal could turn out to be a steal over the next couple of years. He's only played 11 games in the last 2 years because of that ankle injury, but 2018-19, when he played 70-plus, you saw kind of shades of a really versatile, you know, two-position player in the front court that maybe kind of can develop a three-point shot, you know, down the line. Still just 23 years old. So I think the Spurs spent their you know, some of their free agent money pretty well. So I like what San Antonio did on Monday.
I mean, there's a few different things that leap out to me. Obviously, it's a huge victory for the Suns to be able to retain Chris Paul and run it back. I like what Miami did in the abstract, at least, age issues notwithstanding. I kind of like what the Lakers – I didn't like what the Lakers did on draft day, but I like what they did in the first hours of free agency. Let me go negative, actually, for a second here. What's going on in Portland? 5 years, 90 for Norm Powell – fine. You made the trade for him. You gave up Gary Trent Jr. You were almost obligated. You had to keep him.
Yes.
Collins walks. You sign Cody Zeller, I guess, as Yusuf Nurkic insurance since he's always hurt. Fine. But clock's ticking, folks. Clock is ticking. This is the summer where the Portland Trailblazers either show substantial progress and substantial just change, period. Break it up. Do something. Find a new home for CJ McCollum, not because he's a bad player, but because he's your best trade piece. Show Damian Lillard that there's a path now. I don't want to get too judgmental after, like, you know, less than 24 hours of free agency. There's a lot of summer left to go, but draft day came and went. First night of free agency came and went. What's going on there? Is there a plan? What is it? And maybe the Powell signing means that it's now easier to part with CJ McCollum, but I'm very curious to see what happens, because if this is all there is, then I cannot imagine Lillard's going to return home from Tokyo a very happy person, even if he does have a gold medal.
Well, I wonder, I don't disagree with you that, you know, they're one of those teams that didn't accomplish much on the first day of free agency. But at the same time, they were always limited. Like, they didn't have cap
sure.
flexibility.
Absolutely.
Their only asset is CJ McCollum, frankly. Like, they had to bring back Norman Powell, you're right, because Powell sort of had them over a barrel because of what they traded to go and get him. And now the question becomes, will they run it back with some fringy type moves? You know, there's going to be a lot of guys out there, you know, as the music stops and the money's gone, they'll be signing cheaper deals that can certainly help. But the Blazers kind of did that the last couple of years with some of the moves they made in previous off seasons. And I don't know what difference makers are going to be out there. Like, they clearly want to get better on the defensive end. That's important. So maybe you try to find some defensive minded guys that are out there you can plug in at wing positions. But to me, it's either you trade CJ McCollum for something substantial, or you hope that Chauncey Billups is a miracle worker. Like, that's kind of what it comes down to. I mean, and look, Neil O'Shea, the GM there, kind of gave out signals that there were coaching issues rather than roster issues. Now, I think we both probably disagree with them that there's some serious yes. roster issues there. But, you know, at the press conference to announce the right after the firing of Terry Stotts, he did say that it seemed like he believed there were coaching issues more than roster issues there. So maybe he believes that Chauncey Billups led team is going to be better defensively. It's going to make them better overall. I just don't see it. I think that if you're going to make a change, it's going to have to involve CJ McCollum. There's really no two ways around it.
I agree. And, you know, listen, Neil O'Shea can say it was more about coaching than personnel. That's a somewhat self-serving message for a GM to provide. Fine. I don't think Damian Lillard probably sees it that way.
He doesn't. He said as much. He said that, like, I was listening in on his conference call where he's like, yeah, I don't know how you can look at this roster and say it's a championship roster. He's not wrong.
Right.
Like,
which is rough, but it's true. So, yeah, clock is ticking, and it's ticking more loudly today than it was last night, and will continue to. So I'm very curious to see what happens next for the Blazers, because something's got to move.
Anybody, your day two and day three guys you're looking at? I mean, Schroeder's an easy answer for this because he's probably one of the biggest names left on the market. Do you have anybody else out there that you're...
I mean, There's a couple lingering things, like, you know, I don't know if Carmelo's a difference maker at this stage, but Mark Stein reporting that he's looking at the Lakers and Knicks. Stein also says Patty Mills is picking between the Warriors, Lakers, and Nets. I think Mills is a really nice player to have on your bench for one of those teams.
Who's having an excellent, excellent Olympic cycle. Not that that matters because, you know, Ricky Rubio plays like an MVP in every Olympics, but Patty Mills has been playing excellent for Australia these Olympics.
I think my other curiosities are more about guys who are not free agents. It's more of, where does Kemba get rerouted? Where does Ben Simmons land? Where does CJ McCollum land? If CJ McCollum doesn't land anywhere, does that mean that Dame Lillard is instead going somewhere because it means they couldn't do anything? And by the way, Kawhi Leonard has not signed an extension yet that we all expect, or a new contract with the Clippers that we all expect. I think it will probably still happen, but kind of curious that something that was as viewed as not automatic, but a near certainty did not happen on night one.
I think Kemba's interesting because Oklahoma City, from what I was told, is, you know, if you want to see the medicals for Kemba Walker, you can. Like, they're basically trying to cooperate as best, which is not surprising. That's what Oklahoma City does. Like, they, when they take on a veteran, whether it's Carmelo or Al Horford or now Kemba Walker, like, they work with these guys to find them a situation that works for them and a trade that works for Oklahoma City. So, from what I've been told, that if you want to see the medicals for Kemba Walker, you can, and see if that knee is going to hold up. It might be a case, though, if the Thunder can't get, like, the Mavericks to bite or the Knicks to bite or any of those other teams without point guards to bite, they may have to bring him in and kind of show the world that he can play and get him, put him out there for the first half of the season before you find a taker for Kemba Walker. So, yeah, I think Patty Mills is really interesting as a free agent. I think he'd help a lot of teams out there. You name those contenders that are going to be in the mix for him. I am fascinated by Schroeder. I don't know how this song ends for Dennis Schroeder. Like, does it end with him signing like a $5 million one-year deal with somebody? Like, I don't think so, but, you know, put a gun to my head, I'm not sure who is going to open the vault at this point for Dennis Schroeder. I don't know what vault is left to be opened at this point. I don't know who has the money that they're willing to commit to a player like Dennis Schroeder. So, that'll be interesting day two, Howard, but we will reconvene on that at a later date. Good stuff, man. We will do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.